At last, they reached an estuary filled with salty water. They realized they must be close to the gulf, but they couldn't find the sea. Instead, they kept struggling through mile after mile of coastal wetlands. Exhaustion eventually forced them to turn around and head south without ever setting eyes on the gulf. The journey south proved even worse. Their supply of food began running out, and the British explorers had little idea how to hunt in Australia for their meals. Gray shot a python, but when he ate it, he contracted dysentery and died. Burke, King, and Wills struggled on toward Cooper Creek for months. When they arrived back at their camp, they found it abandoned. The rest of the explorers had reached Cooper Creek and waited for 3 months. When the advance party failed to return, they had headed for home, taking all the food with them. Burke, Wills, and King realized that if they tried to follow the rest of the explorers back south, they would starve. They needed to find help as soon as possible. To the west, they knew there was a cattle station, but to reach it, the three explorers would have to cross an expanse of swamps and then a long stretch of desert. Then they would find the cattle station near the foot of Mount Hopeless. Burke, Wills, and King agreed on this dangerous change of plan and headed west. The swamps turned into a maze of creeks, and as they struggled to find the way out, they grew weaker. Their camels suffered even more, dying one by one. Eventually, only one was left. Now their trip across the desert would be doomed because the sole surviving camel wouldn't be able to carry enough water. It was then, in their greatest desperation, that the explorers met the Yandruwanda. To Yandruwanda, this place was not a godforsaken wilderness, but a place they'd called home for thousands of years. When the Europeans stumbled into the territory, the Yandruwanda assumed they had fallen under a spell that caused them to wander aimlessly, unable to return to the place they had come from. Nevertheless, the Yandruwanda welcomed Burke, King, and Wills. They let the explorers camp by their watering hole and fed them fish and nardoo bread. Over the next few weeks, the Europeans regained some of their strength. Wills even grew friendly with some of the Yandruwanda. But Burke felt humiliated that they had to accept charity from savages. Surely they shouldn't need help from an inferior race. Their superior intelligence alone should have sufficed. This resentment apparently led to conflicts between the travelers and their hosts, causing the Yandruwanda to pack up their camp and slip away. Burke, King, and Wills were left again to rely only on their intelligence. They tried to fish the local watering holes, but couldn't catch anything. It's not clear why they failed where the Yandruwanda succeeded so well. One possibility is that they didn't realize they should use nets like the Yandruwanda. Even if they wanted to use nets, though, they probably had no idea how to fashion them from the local plants. Without enough fish to eat, the explorers turned to nardoo. They boiled the plants and ate 4 or 5 pounds worth of the stuff every day. But no matter how much they ate, they kept growing more gaunt. I am weaker than ever, although I have a good appetite and relish the nardoo much, but it seems to give us no nutriment, Wills wrote in his journal. Within a month after the trio parted ways with the Yandruwanda, Wills was dead. Burke and King buried his body and tried to find a way out of the swampy maze. Before long, Burke collapsed and died, and King was now alone. He grew dangerously ill as well as he wandered the swamps, until he ran into a second group of Yandruwanda. They took him in once more. Nestled in their culture, King recovered. King spent a month in their company before a rescue party from Melbourne found him. They brought King home, where he recounted his misadventures to the city's reporters. News of the expedition quickly traveled around the world, and for years afterward, Australians repeated the story until it became a patriotic fable of heroism. Burke and Wills were celebrated with statues, coins, and stamps. Yet their achievement was to have died in a place where others had thrived for thousands of years. The Yandruwanda got no honors for that. In the years after the Burke and Wills expedition, European anthropologists began scientifically studying the culture of the Australian Aboriginals. They also studied cultures on other continents and remote islands. They would contact isolated groups of people and spend years with them, systematically documenting the words in their languages, their creation stories, their rules for marriage. Anthropologists looked for universal patterns, for variations from place to place. As skeletons of ancient humans came to light in caves, they fit their observations of living cultures into a history of humankind that extended back thousands of years. Victorian anthropologists liked to build a simple history that followed a line of progress predictably ending with their own European culture. But in the early 1900s, as anthropology matured, the line was replaced by a branching tree representing the diversification of cultures over time. The tree of culture took on a striking resemblance to the tree of life. Many anthropologists began to borrow ideas and methods from evolutionary biology in the hopes of coming up with a scientifically precise theory of their own. They wanted to distill culture into mathematical equations to make predictions about how cultures change. For most of the 20th century, the work of these evolution-inspired anthropologists didn't draw much notice outside of academic circles. In 1976, however, the British evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins offered an idea about culture that became a cultural force of its own, the meme. Dawkins unveiled memes at the end of his first book, The Selfish Gene. The book mostly concerns itself with genes and biological evolution. The most important quality of a gene, Dawkins argued, did not lie in the details of its chemistry. What mattered about a gene was that it could be inherited. When parents have children, a new copy of the gene gets replicated, and those genes that do a better job of getting replicated become more common over the generations. In a sense, Dawkins argued, we exist simply as vehicles that genes build to get themselves transported into the future. At the end of The Selfish Gene, Dawkins added a provocative coda. He argued that replicators didn't have to be made from DNA. Astronauts traveling to another world might find life built from some alternate molecules, and we didn't even have to go to space to find other replicators. I think a new kind of replicator has recently emerged on this very planet, Dawkins declared. With the emergence of humanity, Earth was overrun with self-replicating pieces of culture. Tunes, ideas, catchphrases, clothes fashions, ways of making pots or of building arches, Dawkins wrote. These new replicators deserved a name of their own, he decided, one as catchy as gene. He dubbed them memes, hearkening back to the Greek word for an imitated thing. When we die, Dawkins said, there are two things we can leave behind us, genes and memes. Dawkins wrote about memes so beguilingly that the concept lodged itself in the heads of many readers. Some researchers tried to build a science out of memes, even launching the Journal of Memetics. They used memes to explain religions. They claimed that memes were responsible for the evolution of our big brains, and the appeal of memes reached far beyond academic circles. It became a popular label for trends and slogans. Advertisers saw themselves as meme designers, and when the internet arose, it proved to be an environment tailor-made for memes. The net has effectively become a meme factory, the Financial Times declared in 1996. In 1996, only 2% of the world's population was on the internet. They struggled to reach it from sluggish desktop computers and through screeching modems. In the following decades, the internet expanded its reach, infiltrating phones and cars and refrigerators. By 2016, almost half the world was prowling its nodes. The early listservs and forums gave way to giant social media platforms. Across this new memetic ecosystem, lolcats and the crazy nasty-ass honey badger began to roam. A website called Know Your Meme cataloged thousands of digital replicators to help the befuddled keep up with new memes and to help the forgetful to recall those of years gone by. The 2016 United States presidential election became a war of memes as operatives looked for the stories and photographs, genuine or doctored, that could spread a political message. The nature of the internet itself gave memes extra legitimacy. A gene, Dawkins often observed, is digital. It encodes a protein or an RNA molecule in a string of bases, with only four possible choices for each position. Because genes are digital, they have the potential to be replicated precisely. A computer file, made up of a string of zeros and ones, can be copied just as accurately. Of course, both kinds of digital replication can fall short of perfection, acquiring mistakes thanks to sloppy enzymes or a dropped server connection. But molecular proofreading and error correction software can fix most of them. Social media platforms have worked hard to make this replication not merely perfect, but easy. You don't have to dig into the HTML code for your favorite political slogan or your favorite clip of an insane Russian driver. You press share. You retweet. It's not just easy to spread memes. It's also easy to track them. Data scientists can track memes with all the numerical precision of a geneticist following an allele for antibiotic resistance in a petri dish. 40 years after the publication of The Selfish Gene, Dawkins wrote an epilogue to an anniversary edition in which he looked back at his idea with satisfaction. "The word meme seems to be turning out to be a good meme," he declared. It's entirely possible, though, that you have never heard of the crazy, nasty-ass honey badger. An internet meme is successful only insofar as it holds people's attention long enough for them to be amused or horrified by it, and to feel moved to transmit it to other people. They don't endure in people's minds very well. They don't combine with other concepts or values to grow into a more complex cultural development. Internet memes get knocked out of the spotlight by the next amusement, the next horror. The nasty-ass honey badger never taught anyone how to eat Nardu. Dawkins had broader ambitions for memes, to explain everything from technology to religion. But those ambitions have mostly gone unmet. The Journal of Memetics shut down in 2005, and no new journal took its place. Many researchers who study culture decided memes were too superficial to help them dig deeper. In 2003, the Stanford scientists Paul Ehrlich and Marcus Feldman went so far as to declare memes ready for their scientific funeral. "Identifying the basic mechanisms by which our culture evolves will be difficult," they said. The most recent attempts using a meme approach appear to be a dead end. Instead of dissecting memes, many researchers searched for the biological building blocks that made human culture possible in the first place. The most fundamental ingredient seems to be learning. But not just any learning will do. Wills and Burke might well have gotten back safely to Melbourne if they had been able to learn for themselves how to prepare Nardu by dint of their own reasoning. But they simply weren't smart enough, certainly not as smart as the collective experience of hundreds of generations of Yandru Wanda. Culture runs on social learning, on the ability of people to learn from other people. Yet it's become clear that social learning evolved long before human culture. Our species has no monopoly on that skill. In 2016, a team of scientists discovered that even bumblebees can learn cultural practices from one another. Lars Chitka, a biologist at Queen Mary University of London, and his colleagues created an experiment in which bumblebees had to learn how to get sugar out of fake flowers. Each flower was a blue plastic disc with a well at the center holding a dollop of glucose. Chitka and his colleagues tied a string to each of the flowers and tucked them under a tiny transparent table made of plexiglass. The scientists then put bees into this flower chamber and observed them. The bees could see the flowers through the plexiglass, but could not directly reach them. They could eat the sugar only if they first pulled on the string to draw the flower out from under the table. Chitka and his colleagues put 291 bees to this test. Not one could figure out how to get to the sugar. To make the puzzle easier for the bees to solve, the scientists broke it down into simpler tasks. In the first lesson, the bees could land directly on the flowers and drink from them. After the bees learned that they could get food from the flowers, the scientists presented them with a new challenge. They tied a string to each flower and nudged them only partway under the plexiglass table. The bees were now trained well enough to fly straight to the flower. But to reach the sugar, they had to push their heads against the edge of the table and extend their tongues. Once they learned this new technique, the researchers pushed the flowers completely out of reach underneath the table. Now the bees could get the sugar only if they pulled the string to draw out the flower. Once their task was broken down into these smaller puzzles, some of the bees could learn how to drink the sugar by pulling on the string. Only 23 of 40 bees figured out the task completely, though, and only after 5 hours of lessons. But, after all that hard work, Chitka and his colleagues had 23 trained bees. Now the scientists could see if other bees could learn from them. Chitka and his colleagues built a tiny observation box where untrained bees could sit and watch the trained bees go about pulling out the flowers and drinking sugar. Each untrained bee got to watch 10 different bees perform the entire routine. When Chitka then put the observers into the flower chamber, 60% of them, 15 out of 25, headed to the plexiglass, tugged on the string, and pulled out the flower. That experiment showed that the bumblebees could learn by observing other bees. For his last study, Chitka wanted to see whether the practice of string pulling could spread, meme-like, through a group of insects. Chitka maintains a number of colonies in his lab, each made up of a few dozen bumblebees. From 3 colonies, Chitka and his colleagues picked out a single bee to train. They returned it to its colony, and then hooked up a tunnel so that any of the bees could walk into the flower chamber if they were so inclined. The scientists then played the role of doorman, letting two bees at a time crawl down the tunnel of the colony to the flowers on a first-come, first-served basis. They repeated this procedure 150 times with each colony, and then tested the bees to see how many knew to get the sugar by pulling the string. In each colony, they found, about half the bees had learned the lesson. Only some of the bees learned directly from the original trained insect. The rest of them learned second-hand, or even third- or fourth-hand. In fact, the original trained bee in one of the colonies died in the middle of the experiment, yet the string pulling continued to spread. Her intellectual legacy extended well beyond her own life. What makes these experiments especially striking is that scientists have not found any sign that bumblebees in the wild learn from each other. For bumblebees, social learning may be a dormant skill, one that can be awakened only by an unnatural experiment. Vertebrates, on the other hand, don't need a scientist to help them show off their social learning. They learn from each other on a regular basis in the wild, and their cultural practices can last for years, and perhaps far longer. One of the first of these animal traditions to be documented arose in 1921 in a small English town called Swathling. The people of Swathling were annoyed to find that someone was vandalizing the milk bottles on their doorsteps. The foil caps that covered the mouths of the bottles were pierced, torn, and sometimes ripped clean away. It turned out that the vandals were birds, in particular a chickadee-like species called the blue tit. The birds would land on a bottle, pull away the foil, and then sip from the layer of cream atop the milk. Birdwatchers were so taken with the innovation that they looked for it in other villages and kept looking for it for years. In 1949, two scientists, James Fisher and Robert Hind, contacted birders and mapped three decades of their observations across much of the country. These maps revealed that a few blue tits had independently started ripping milk bottle foil. Other members of their species took up the practice as well, either after watching them in action or just discovering a cap torn by another bird. The movement of birds between towns spread the foil ripping long after the original inventors had died. The practice endured across much of Britain for decades, finally disappearing when milkmen stopped delivering foil-covered bottles of milk each morning. Yet the birds have not lost their capacity to invent new ways to get food or to inherit them from other birds. In 2015, Ben Sheldon of Oxford University and his colleagues gave a lesson to birds known as great tits, close relatives of blue tits. They captured wild birds in a forest and took them into their lab, where they were taught how to open a box full of mealworms. Each bird learned one of two ways to open the box, either sliding a red door to the left or a blue door to the right. The scientists set more of the boxes out in the woods, where they released the tutored birds. Now in the wild, the birds continued to open the boxes as they had been taught in the lab, opening either the red or blue door, and the wild birds around them watched what they did. Three-quarters of the forest's population ultimately learned how to get mealworms out of the boxes. The tradition spread through the social networks of the birds, mostly among relatives or friendly birds that spent a lot of time together. And they reliably passed on the technique they had seen other birds use. Some learned to open the red door, the others the blue. Sheldon and his colleagues also found that the memory of the birds helped extend their traditions. They left the boxes in the forest for 3 weeks and then took them away. Over the next 9 months, over half of the original birds died. The scientists then brought the boxes back to the forest and waited to see what would happen. The older birds started opening them again, and the new generation of birds learned from their elders once more. Other researchers have searched for more animal traditions, and they've found examples everywhere from the open ocean to dense jungles. In 1978, a University of Rhode Island biologist named James Hain and his colleagues discovered a striking case among humpback whales in the Gulf of Maine. When the whales chase after schools of fish, they typically dive about 60 feet underwater and use their blowhole to produce nets of bubbles that corral their prey. Once the fish have retreated into a tight clump, the whales lunge at them with an open mouth. In 1978, while observing whales in the Gulf of Maine, Hain spotted a single animal use a new technique. Before spraying a bubble net, the whale first slapped the water with the underside of its tail. In the years that followed, whale observers recorded other animals in the Gulf slapping the water as well. The proportion of whales performing this so-called lobtail feeding increased in fits and starts for decades. In 2013, Luke Rendell of the University of St. Andrews, Scotland, and his colleagues mapped the records of lobtail feeding onto the social network of the whales. Humpback whales have a loose social organization, coming together into small groups to feed and mate. Rendell found that whales typically didn't just start spontaneously lobtail feeding on their own. Spending time with a proficient lobtailer made them much more likely to try out the method for themselves. Rendell argued that this new tradition became entrenched in the Gulf of Maine for the same reason that blue tits started drinking cream. We changed their food supply. The whales fed on herring until the stocks collapsed due to human overfishing. They then switched to sand lances for their prey. It's possible that a whale discovered that smacking the water stunned the sand lances, preventing them from escaping whale attacks. When scientists can't observe a new tradition take hold in the wild, which is most of the time, they can get some clues to its history by simply comparing the populations that make up a species. The chimpanzees that live in the Kibale forest in Uganda, for example, use sticks to extract honey from logs. In the Budongo forest, not far away, chimpanzees get honey in a different way. They chew up leaves and then use them as a sponge. Rather than being some instinct shared by all chimpanzees, these behaviors were probably invented by some innovative chimpanzees and then became local traditions. The traditions of chimpanzees are especially important to understanding human culture because they are our closest living relatives. Primatologists have cataloged dozens of traditions among these apes, many found only in some populations but not others. Any one population may have a unique combination of traditions for getting food, for using plants as medicine, for grooming each other, for making calls to other chimpanzees, for performing courtship rituals. Andrew Whiten, an expert on animal traditions at the University of St. Andrews, has argued that these bundles of traditions should be treated as cultures. If Whiten is right, that means that our cultural history reaches back at least 7 million years, to our common ancestor with chimpanzees. Only after our ancestors split off from other apes did truly human culture emerge. One way to study its rise is to run experiments in which humans and other species perform the same task and then see how they do it differently. At the University of St. Andrews, a graduate student named Lewis Dean designed one such test. He created a puzzle box that dispensed rewards with the right combination of actions. When monkeys and chimpanzees tried to solve the box, they were rewarded with fruit. 3- and 4-year-old children got shiny stickers. To get the rewards, the subjects had to uncover 3 hidden chutes. They could reveal the first chute by sliding a door to one side. Once they learned how to do this, they could learn how to push a button on the box that let them slide the door farther, revealing the second chute. And if they then turned a dial in the right direction, they could slide the door farther still, revealing the third chute. Dean showed the box to 2 groups of capuchin monkeys. To get them started, he slid the door open to demonstrate how to get the first reward, but he then left them to their own devices after that. All told, each group of monkeys played with the puzzle box for 53 hours, and yet, after all that time, only 2 of the monkeys learned how to get the second reward. None got the third. When Dean put the puzzle box in front of chimpanzees, they fared almost as poorly. After 30 hours, only 4 chimpanzees got the second reward, and only 1 got the third. The children, who were 3 or 4 years old, did far better. Dean showed the box to 8 groups, each consisting of up to 5 children. In 5 of the groups, at least 2 children figured out how to open up the third chute. Many others managed to get the second one, and they made all this progress in just 2.5 hours. The children did so well because they, unlike the primates, could go beyond simply solving isolated problems. They could accumulate knowledge, and they did so as a group. When some of the children figured out how to reveal the first chute, the other children could learn it from them. And then the other children could use their own insights to add a new step in the procedure, revealing the second chute. Many anthropologists now argue that this so-called cumulative culture is a hallmark of our species. The cultural practices the chimpanzees carry out are simple, requiring just a few steps to complete. They have never shown any capacity to learn a practice and then build on it. Humans, by contrast, are constantly adding on to the practices they've learned, creating complex new forms of culture. They can build up elaborate recipes for Nardu, modify canoes until they are able to cross the Pacific, and turn wooden guitars into electric ones. Dean's experiment illuminates a few of the crucial traits that make cumulative culture possible. Friendliness matters, for one thing. When Dean gave the puzzle box to the primates, they competed over it rather than cooperating. The ones that figured out how to get fruit out of a chute always gobbled it up, never sharing it with others. The children, on the other hand, were more comfortable in each other's company. Some of them even spontaneously gave the stickers they got out of the puzzle box to others who didn't. The friendlier children were, Dean found, the better they did on his test. A number of other studies have come to a similar conclusion. We humans have evolved more tolerance for each other than other species. That gives us more opportunity to learn from one another, and that extra social learning may be crucial for making culture cumulative. The children in Dean's experiments stood apart from the chimpanzees and monkeys in a second way. They sometimes taught each other. When children figured out how to open a new chute, they sometimes demonstrated to the others how to do it. Dean never witnessed a single lesson taught by the chimpanzees or the capuchins. Anthropologists were slow to recognize how important teaching has been to our species. In the mid-1900s, Margaret Mead and other experts claimed that teaching was merely a peculiar feature of Western societies, a cultural penchant for herding children into schools. In other cultures, children were supposedly left to their own devices to learn for themselves. In recent years, though, many anthropologists have changed their minds, in part because they've reconsidered what it really means to teach. Teaching doesn't have to happen in a lecture hall or run on a semester schedule. At its essence, teaching is a behavior that one person uses to help another person learn a skill or acquire a piece of information. And by that definition, teaching appears to be common in human societies. In the rainforests of Central Africa, for example, Barry Hewlett, an anthropologist at the University of British Columbia, found evidence for teaching among the Akka, a group of pygmy hunter-gatherers. The Akka don't run schools, and they don't even have a word for teach. And yet Hewlett found that adults are constantly teaching children. The lessons happen in brief bouts, some as short as a few seconds. Sometimes the adults don't utter a word, but they still manage to convey crucial lessons to their young children, such as how to build a fire, how to use a machete, and how to find yams and dig them out of the ground. Once researchers settled on their new definition of teaching, they wondered if other species teach as well. They have found only a few cases where the answer seems to be yes. Meerkats are one. In the deserts of southern Africa, they hunt many species of prey, some of which, like scorpions, are dangerous. Killing and eating a scorpion without getting fatally stung is a difficult skill to learn. Adult meerkats make it easier for pups by letting them practice safely. They start by bringing dead scorpions to their young. When the pups get older, the adults only wound the scorpions and also make sure to rip off their stingers. Later, when the pups have developed some skill at handling live scorpions, their parents don't wound their prey as badly. At the end of the lessons, the pups are ready to kill live scorpions on their own. As impressive as this teaching may be, meerkats appear to be an exception among animals rather than the rule. Even among our closest relative, animal teachers appear to be rare. In 2016, researchers from Washington State University reported that they had spotted chimpanzee teachers in a forest in the Republic of Congo. The adult chimpanzees there have a cultural practice of fashioning sticks into tools for fishing termites. Sometimes the adults will hand their tools to a young chimpanzee so that it can give it a try. Given the decades that scientists have been watching chimpanzees in the wild and in zoos, it's remarkable that the Washington State University team made the first observation of any behavior that might be called teaching. Teaching would make a tremendous difference to the well-being of chimpanzees. Cracking nuts with stones is so difficult that young chimpanzees can take as long as 4 years to master the skill. Yet in all that time, no one has seen an adult chimpanzee offer some guidance. For humans, by contrast, teaching comes easily. So easily that children will spontaneously teach each other about games and toys. This tendency, which goes by the technical term natural pedagogy, may be rare in the animal kingdom because it demands a lot from teachers and students alike. Successful teachers have to be able to gauge what their students do and don't know, which demands an ability to get inside their heads. Teachers also need to communicate information clearly so that their students will be likely to learn something new. If teachers fail at any of these challenges, all their efforts are wasted. What's more, the best teachers in the world can't teach students unable to absorb their lessons. Humans seem to have evolved to be especially good students. One of the most important adaptations we've evolved, and one of the strangest, is what Derek Lyons was testing by studying Charlotte. Extreme imitation. Children are willing to imitate teachers even when they should know better. In a species like ours, in which teachers transmit important lessons, extreme imitation is a smart strategy. Children don't have to struggle to reinvent all of human culture from scratch. Dean's experiment gives a glimpse at imitation's value. The children who tried solving his puzzle box imitated each other fairly often, and the children who imitated the most got the most rewards. There are certainly risks to imitating someone rather than wondering about each step along the way. If children end up imitating people who don't know what they're doing, they'll reproduce failure. But humans appear to have evolved some defenses against this sort of mistake. If children can choose whom to direct their attention, they'll tend to focus on adults who appear to be trustworthy experts. The theory of natural pedagogy, the British psychologist Cecilia Hayes says, suggests that blind trust is at least as important as smart thinking. These ingredients for cumulative culture must have emerged after our ancestors split off from the ancestors of chimpanzees some 7 million years ago. We don't have a lot of evidence to narrow that window and pin down the precise timing of when we started teaching, imitating to the extreme, and the like. We have to rely mostly on the material products of cumulative culture. You can tell that living humans have cumulative culture by their stuff. If you haul together all the man-made objects in an Akka camp, they'd be different from what you'd collect from a Greenland Inuit settlement or a middle-class house in Nebraska. And if you collect objects from a single place stretching over a span of thousands of years, say, pottery from Egypt, you'll find one set of objects morphing into new sets. But if you try to reach back millions of years, the evidence gets scarce. The technological record of humans and their ancestors reaches back 3.3 million years. In 2015, researchers in Kenya discovered small chipped stones that could be used to chop, hammer, or cut. It's possible that hominins used these tools to scavenge meat from dead carcasses. A million years later, hominins in Tanzania were still making these tools, but the shape of these pieces of rock, known as Oldowan tools, reveals a change of thought. The hominins who made them understood how to knock off a sharp flake from a rock while leaving the rock intact enough to yield another flake. They could thus produce a number of tools of about the same size and shape, all made from a single rock. This skill probably had to be taught. Young hominins likely needed a teacher to demonstrate how to knock off flakes, to communicate its goal, and to help them improve their technique. It wasn't until about 1.8 million years ago that new kinds of technology emerged. The most striking of the next generation of tools was a large, teardrop-shaped hand axe. The species Homo erectus carried these hand axes to Asia and Europe and kept making them for over a million years. They made the axes from flint, basalt, quartz, and even obsidian, but the overall shape stayed pretty much the same. These hand axes hint that Homo erectus was approaching our level of cultural prowess. The tools may look crude to our modern eye, but a 21st century human would be hard-pressed to make them from scratch. First, you'd need to find the right supply of rocks. I'm guessing you don't know where the nearest vein of obsidian is to be found. And then you'd need to strike one rock with another many times over to craft the proper shape. Paleoanthropologists sometimes run experiments to see how much prowess is required for making hand axes. They give people a finished model and some rocks they can thwack together. Their subjects always fail. It takes years for aficionados of the Pleistocene to learn how to make a good hand axe. That hard-earned skill has led Alex Masudi, a paleoanthropologist at the University of Exeter, and his colleagues, to the conclusion that Homo erectus used extremely careful imitation to make their hand axes. A careless hand axe maker might have been blinded by a flying shard or maimed by a badly aimed chop. Observing skilled toolmakers would give novices the knowledge necessary to avoid such injuries. Careful imitation could also explain why hand axes managed to stay so similar to each other for over a million years. If Homo erectus simply looked over old hand axes to guess how to make them, they would have accidentally introduced little variations to their craft. Over a few thousand years, those mismatches would have caused the hand axe to drift farther away from its original shape. Scientists cannot find clear evidence of full-blown cumulative culture until our own species emerged about 300,000 years ago in Africa. As Homo sapiens spread out across the continent, our ancestors developed new shapes and styles for their stone tools. The tools in Morocco became distinctive from those of Kenya and South Africa. Early humans then started using these stone tools to work other materials, like antlers and eggshells. They combined their creations into new inventions, like spear throwers or nets to hunt for game. Artwork, from geometric decorations on eggshells to human figurines, also emerged. Neanderthals and Denisovans seem to have never crossed this threshold. Language might be one reason for the difference. Our own ancestors may have gained the power of full-blown speech, making it much easier to cooperate on a hunt for game or a search for tubers. It would have made teaching more effective, too, bringing a precision and depth to lessons. The benefits of language could account for why our ancestors reached a higher population density than Neanderthals and Denisovans. You can estimate this by measuring the genetic diversity in samples of ancient DNA. And our sheer numbers may have then helped bring about cumulative culture. With more people around, our ancestors had more opportunities to meet people and encounter new ideas they could adopt. To get a rough estimate of what this early social network would have looked like, Kim Hill, an anthropologist at Arizona State University, and his colleagues interviewed hundreds of hunter-gatherers from two tribes, the Aceh of Paraguay and the Hadza of Tanzania. Both tribes are made up of small bands. Hill and his colleagues drew up a list of people in a number of bands and asked the Aceh and Hadza men if they had ever met anyone on the list. They concluded that each man had a social universe of about 1,000 people. That's far bigger than the social universe of any other primate. Male chimpanzees interact with only 20 other males in their entire lifetime. Once all these pieces fell into place, cumulative culture promptly exploded. Humans could inherit complicated cultural practices, tinker with them, and pass them accurately onward to future generations. It was the dawn of a new form of heredity, with some striking parallels to the dawn of the first heredity systems on the early Earth. Life's early genomes were so prone to errors as they replicated that they couldn't get large. Once life gained a faithful form of inheritance, it could leap to complex cells. Humans, likewise, may have crossed a threshold and shot into a new universe of complex culture. An Aboriginal Australian girl born 50,000 years ago received a tremendous inheritance from her ancestors. It was made up of genes from her parents, possibly along with some epigenetic marks. She inherited some of her microbiome from her mother, along with the mitochondria that were once independent bacteria billions of years ago. As an infant, she began to hear the language of her group and to learn it. She inherited customs for interacting with people, including rules that applied within her family and others for strangers. Her mother and sisters probably taught her the vast compendium of knowledge previous generations had amassed about how to prepare meals, how to deliver babies, how to use plants to heal the sick. She inherited an Aboriginal cosmology, one that placed her and everyone she knew in a meaningful place in the world. She also inherited something else, a human-altered environment. The environment shapes every species that inhabits it. As species struggle to survive, they evolve adaptations to their surroundings, whether they're fish gaining antifreeze in the Arctic Ocean or hummingbirds evolving oxygen-hungry blood for flying over the Andes. But some species can reverse the equation. Even as the environment shapes them, they shape their environment. Elephants, for example, tear down tree branches and split their trunks down the center. Lizards, insects, and other animals can then invade these trees, which were previously off-limits to them. The rampages of the elephants open light into dense forests, allowing small plants to sprout up, providing food to animals like gorillas and bush pigs. Elephants can convert open woodlands into savannas and keep them cleared and fertilized with their dung. The elephants thus live in a habitat of their own making. At first, our ancestors had little effect on their environment. They were just apes that could walk on two legs in search of fruit, seeds, and tubers, along with the occasional carcass they scavenged, along with hyenas and vultures. But then they started to alter their surroundings. Their first environment-changing tool was probably fire. The oldest known evidence for the use of fire lies in a cave in South Africa. There, scientists have found bits of burned bone and plant matter dating back a million years. For hundreds of thousands of years, hominins probably made fires only in hearths, probably to cook food. But Homo sapiens discovered additional uses for it. By 164,000 years ago, people in South Africa were lighting fires in order to bake soil, turning it into a rock-like material that could be sculpted into tools. And by 75,000 years ago, there's evidence in South Africa that people were setting grasslands on fire, possibly to clear them for earlier hunting. The flames wiped out the above-ground plants, but also stimulated the underground tubers to grow back at a much greater density. By the time people reached Australia, they were using fire to reshape entire landscapes. Aboriginals walked through grasslands with fire sticks perpetually lit. The continent itself still records the first fire sticks, with a thin new layer of charcoal buried several yards in the earth. Fire was so much a part of Aboriginal life that it enveloped their cosmology. In one creation story, people and animals started out looking very different. A sacred spirit used a fire stick to set the entire world ablaze, and only after they were scorched did living things take on the appearance they have today. When the first Europeans finally set eyes on Australia, it was still burning. "We saw either smoke by day or fires by night, wherever we came," Captain James Cook wrote in his journal in 1770. Aboriginals also used fire as a hunting weapon, torching grasslands to flush out kangaroos, lizards, snakes, and other game. These burns could last for days. Elsewhere, they burned forests to foster the growth of plants they wanted to harvest and animals they wanted to eat. These fires were set carefully so as not to destroy sacred trees. Aboriginals inherited the rules for burning along with the rest of their culture, and they also inherited the landscape that the fires of their ancestors produced. Fire was just one of many tools that humans used to hunt. They also invented spears, snares, nets, and fish hooks. They taught their children how to make these new tools and also taught them how to use them. Culture helped turn humans into unmatched hunters, driving species like mammoths and ground sloths to extinction. These large mammals were themselves ecosystem engineers, and so their disappearance had profound impacts on their environments. Some trees grew giant fruits to ensure their seeds would be spread in dung of the giant creature. Now their seeds fell to the ground close by them. Some ecologists have argued that once Siberia's grasslands lost their mammoths and other giant mammals, moss took over and established today's tundras. But humans also influenced plants simply through the cultural practices they developed to eat them. People who lived in rainforests gathered fruits from wild trees and brought them to their camps to prepare for meals. After they moved on, the seeds stayed behind, growing into wild orchards that they could revisit in later years. In Iran, foragers brought wild beans from the hillsides to grow alongside rivers where they'd be easier to harvest. When the foragers collected seeds for the next growing season, they unconsciously favored the plants with the variants that let them grow faster in the new environment. The evolution of the plants was now guided by humanity. Starting roughly 10,000 years ago, with the end of the last ice age, some of these tended plants evolved under human care into domesticated crops. In the Fertile Crescent, wheat, millet, beans, and other plants were transformed. In China, it was rice. In Africa, sorghum. In Mexico, a weed called teosinte became corn. And in some of these same places, wild animals were domesticated into livestock such as cows, goats, and sheep. The same capacity for cumulative culture that had already spread humans to all the continents save Antarctica now allowed them to convert the wildlands around them into farm fields and grazing pastures. Children in these agricultural communities inherited traditions for farming, and they also inherited lands that had been converted from wilderness long before they were born. The agricultural revolution lofted our species to a far bigger population than before, leaving some farmers desperate for land. They moved into open territories still inhabited by hunter-gatherers, bringing with them the entire package of agriculture, not just the seeds for crops, but also their livestock, their saddles, their hoes, and their inherited wisdom about how to use all of it to harvest food, brew beer, sew leather shoes, and all the rest of their cultural practices. And these farmers continued to accumulate new steps to their traditions. As they learned how to work metals, they could make sickle blades or horseshoes. The environment in which much of humanity was now born had become a domesticated landscape, covered by farms as well as by houses, roads, villages, and cities. It was cultural heredity that led to an agricultural revolution, and it was that revolution that fostered the practice that gave heredity its name. Heirs began to inherit great wealth from their ancestors. There was nothing new about parents bequeathing valuable things to their offspring. You could argue that our reptilian ancestors were doing it 300 million years ago. The females stocked their eggs with protein-rich yolk, sacrificing some of their own physical resources to pass down to their young. Feeding on those provisions inside their eggs, our ancestors hatched in a stronger condition, more likely to survive to adulthood. When our ancestors evolved into mammals some 200 million years ago, mothers could bequeath milk as well. And when our ancestors evolved into lemur-like primates, their young grew dependent on even more gifts from their parents, in the form of food and protection. Our ancestors grew even more reliant on their parents over the last few million years, because they were growing increasingly big brains. Brains, ounce for ounce, demand 20 times more energy than muscle. A human infant needs to channel almost half of the calories it gets every day to fueling its neurons. The human brain doesn't reach full size until about age 10, but even then, it's not done developing. The teenage brain furiously prunes connections between neurons while building long-range links between distant regions. The unique anatomy of the human brain is essential for our unique capacity for cumulative culture. But in the time it takes for the brain to develop, human children need help from their parents to get the necessary fuel. Children 50,000 years ago couldn't just raid a refrigerator whenever they got hungry. Someone had to kill an animal for them, or harvest some plants and cook them over a fire. The few societies that survive today on hunting and gathering can offer a few hints about what things were like when all humans lived that way. At an early age, hunter-gatherer children start helping to find food and to prepare it, but they still eat more calories than they bring in. This deficit shrinks as they get older and can work harder, but it only turns to a surplus when they reach their late teens. Until then, families have to work together to make up for the deficit of their children, not just the parents, but grandparents as well. Some families fare better at this work than others. They may make better arrows, which allow them to take down more game, for example. Hunter-gatherer societies keep this inequality in check with a system of moral judgments. A successful hunter who doesn't share some of his meat with other families will suffer a blow to his reputation. But such rules only rein in inequality. They don't eliminate it. In hunter-gatherer societies, children from successful families still end up getting more food and enjoy better health than children from other families. Their families ally themselves to a bigger social network, one that can provide more help during a drought or some other disaster. Under the right conditions, this inequality in hunter-gatherer societies can grow from one generation to the next. Anthropologists have documented one particularly striking case of such inequality on Vancouver Island. The Nootka people have lived there for at least 4,000 years, catching salmon that swim up the island's rivers to spawn. They could smoke enough fish to feed themselves and still have plenty left over to trade with inland tribes. It was a prosperous way of life, giving the Nootka enough resources to build massive wooden houses and totem poles to honor their ancestors. But it did not leave the Nootka in an egalitarian utopia. The Nootka chiefs held sway over extended families, controlling the best fishing sites on the rivers. Heredity justified and extended their power. Each chief inherited his authority from a distant spirit ancestor. He marked the inheritance of that power by his children with a series of extravagant feasts. Powerful Nootka families grew more powerful over the generations, while others fell into debt. Some Nootka became so destitute that they had to surrender themselves into slavery, moving their families into the houses of their masters. Wherever this sort of inequality emerged in a Nootka village, it could endure for a few centuries before it collapsed. Droughts and other disasters could wipe out the advantages that some families had over others. It's likely that inequality was just as fragile in all hunter-gatherer societies across the world. But the rise of agriculture allowed inequality to explode and endure. In the Near East, for example, foragers gathered wild plants together and stored them in communal granaries. As they switched to farming, they claimed rights to land for growing crops and built private granaries to store their harvests. Farmers who planted superior crops ended up with extra food that they could barter for goods. They could then pass down their land and those goods to their children, who could start farming with huge advantages. It's obvious that inheriting PKU from one's parents is not the same as inheriting the knowledge of how to make Nardoo bread. The first inheritance involves the copying of genetic information that gets brought together in an embryo. The second comes about through years of teaching, expressed in actions and language. Yet they are not utterly different either. Both kinds of inheritance are part of the variation from person to person and from population to population. And both can sustain that variation across generations. At the dawn of the 20th century, scientists came to limit the word heredity to genes. Before long, this narrow definition spread its influence far beyond genetic laboratories. It hangs like a cloud over our most personal experiences of heredity, even if we can't stop trying to smuggle the old traditions of heredity into the new language of genes. We call genetic disorders family curses. A family of rich real estate barons rationalizes its wealth with mysterious genes for success. Genealogy began as an ancient practice of legitimization through ancestry, but we still depend on it to explain how we came to be. When birth certificates and immigration records fail us, we take up DNA to draw branches further back and farther out. We exult in discovering a link to some famous figure in history, as if carrying their alleles makes us special, ignoring the fact that beyond a few generations, we share little or no DNA with our ancestors. We take DNA tests to find out if we're full-blooded Irish or Cherokee or Egyptian, using 16th-century terms that started out as ways to describe racehorses or to divide humans into arbitrary categories, despite the fact that the evidence from that DNA chews holes in those barriers like a termite invasion. There is certainly a history to each chunk of our genetic material, but each one hurtles back through human history in a different direction, leaping from continent to continent. A human genome is a shredded, shuffled sampling of DNA, both from humans and from our extinct near-human relatives. We think of heredity as limited to what normally happens in human families. Two parents combine half their DNA to produce a new offspring, their genes obeying Mendel's law. In truth, heredity does not stop at conception's door. Cells continue to divide, and their daughter cells inherit everything inside them, their mitochondria, their proteins, their chromosomes, and the epigenetic network that gives each cell its state. Our bodies are walking genealogies, the branches distinguished by locked-in networks of genes, mosaic mutations, even by chimeric origins in different people. Germ cells can extend this heredity into new lives, but August Weismann's barrier is far from absolute. An untold number of animals have gained a cancerous immortality by sending forth their tumors to burrow into new hosts for thousands of years on land and at sea. None of this is to say that Weismann himself was wrong. He gave science a new way to think about heredity, one that prepared the ground for the recognition of Mendel's discoveries. By the early 1900s, Mendel's law was allowing geneticists to begin making sense of human heredity, explaining the now-you-see-it-now-you-don't evasion of traits through the generations that left even Darwin baffled. The easiest mysteries it solved were diseases caused by a single dominant allele or a pair of recessive ones like PKU. But for other traits, including ones as seemingly simple as height, heredity has become an ocean of explanation. The effect that our biological past has on our height has been shattered into thousands of pieces of influence. Mendel's law also turned out to be exquisitely fragile. It is regularly broken. Gene drives regularly get the better of Mendel's law, carrying genes throughout populations, even at risk of pushing species to extinction. Many species of animals, plants, and fungi themselves sometimes obey Mendel's law, and sometimes find a different way to pass genes down to future generations. Some become both father and mother. They use their own sperm to fertilize their own eggs. Or they simply recombine the chromosomes within a single cell, which then develops into an offspring. Others dispense with gametes altogether, cloning themselves. These species are not rare flukes. They live around us. They grow into forests and coral reefs. They make our bread and beer. Our anthropocentrism also makes it easy to forget that Mendel's law is young. The universe was born with the speed of light fixed at 186,000 miles a second. The mass of an electron was set, and Mendel's law was nowhere in the cosmos to be found. It evolved much later, as far as we know, on only one planet. But on that water-coated rock, heredity had already been unspooling for billions of years when Mendel's law evolved. The microbes and viruses that until then were the sole residents of Earth for over half the history of life did not reproduce by combining germ cells. Nor do they do so today. They follow rules of their own. They can make near-identical copies of their DNA, but that DNA can also slip from one microbe to another, producing patchworks that might never have evolved if heredity could only travel vertically. Microbes evolved new kinds of heredity of their own. It was only in the early 2000s that scientists discovered that many species used CRISPR to gain a defense against viruses, a defense that their descendants could then inherit. We cannot understand the natural world with a simplistic notion of genetic heredity, and some scientists have likewise argued that we must expand our definition of heredity again, to take into account other channels as well, be they culture, epigenetic marks, hitchhiking microbes, or channels we don't even know about yet. In the 1980s, Marcus Feldman and a number of other researchers began trying to build a theory of heredity that could include both culture and genes. Since then, others have tried to widen the theory even more. Russell Bondurianski of the University of New South Wales in Australia and Troy Day of Queen's University in Ontario, Canada, believe it's time to build mathematical equations that can unite genetic and non-genetic forms of heredity in a single description. They lay out their vision in a 2018 book, Not Only Genes. Bondurianski and Day argue that the previous century of research on heredity was based on a fallacy. Geneticists didn't simply champion the gene by finding evidence for it. They rejected the possibility that anything other than genes could carry heredity. Yet the existence of one channel did not necessarily rule out the other. This purely genetic concept of heredity was never firmly backed by evidence or logic, Bondurianski and Day declare. As the genetic concept took hold, research into non-genetic forms faded away. The field's reputation was stained by scandals, as some experiments that supposedly supported non-genetic heredity proved to be shoddy or even fraudulent. But even careful scientists were at a disadvantage. The effects of genes can have a downright arithmetic precision. Simply breeding peas or flies reveals profound facts about how genes are inherited. Non-genetic forms of heredity are harder to distinguish from influences of the environment, and they can be more prone to vanish. Researchers who have tried to document non-genetic heredity have thus had to play a long game of catch-up. Linnaeus laid his eyes on the monstrous Piloria in the 1740s. When I visited Robert Martinson 170 years later, he was still struggling to discover what keeps them monstrous after all these generations. The debate over heredity had reached a different stage. Both sides accepted the reality of the other. No champion of non-genetic heredity denies the power of genes. And of the geneticists I've spoken to, none has outright rejected the idea that heredity can be sustained by things other than genes.
The fight now is over importance.
Some geneticists don't see much to be gained by investigating non-genetic heredity. Other biologists believe that the only way to make sense of traits they find in organisms is to understand how they're transmitted, and sometimes that search will take them beyond genes. One argument in favor of genes and against non-genetic heredity is that genes have sticking power. Our cells are packed with dedicated swarms of proteins and RNA molecules that work together to copy genes, ensuring that new copies are virtually identical to the original ones. The low rate of mutations in our DNA allows an allele to endure for generations. Its sticking power gives natural selection enough time to favor it over other alleles and to drive evolutionary change. Non-genetic heredity can be far more fleeting. Water fleas, tiny invertebrates that live in ponds and streams, use a form of non-genetic heredity to escape predators. If they pick up the odor of a predatory fish, they grow spikes on their heads and tails, making it more likely that a fish will spit them out rather than swallow them. Female water fleas will then produce offspring that grow spikes early in development, even in the absence of any odor of a predator. This shift will endure for several generations, but then it fades away. A new generation of water fleas emerges spike-free. This sort of heredity can't drive evolutionary change, because natural selection can't favor spiked water fleas over spikeless ones for very long. Yet Bondurianski and Day reject this argument against the importance of non-genetic heredity. In some cases, it can actually be quite durable. The fact that Linnaeus's monstrous toad flax are still monstrous demonstrates that heredity can